Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. This week, we are joined once again by birthday boy, Jack Howard. Jack.
Hello, Mark.
It's your birthday. Now you got to pick up the phone. How old are you, Jack?
I'm 16. I'm 29.
29. Wow. Jack, your 20s are nearly over.
I know. I'm glad I'm not one of those people that is dreading 30. I'm kind of looking forward to it. I feel like I'll be able to relax at 30.
Relax because?
I don't know. I think there's something very turbulent about the 20s. I don't know what it is. And I think there's a phenomenon about it that I'm just getting used to now that I'm leaving my 20s. The idea of rushing into life and feeling like you've got to get everything done now and figure it all out. And it's almost like when you're a teenager, it's sort of planned for you. You go to school, you've got that to do, you hang out with your friends, you do your exams, and then you go to university. Like, you know what you're doing. And then when you get to your 20s, all of a sudden, it's like, you're an adult now, figure it out. And I think that I panicked and didn't know what to do and just sort of scrambled. And I thought that was a new thing because we're in the internet age and everything's so immediate now. I thought that was maybe a new phenomenon for my generation. And then I heard the Billy Joel song, Vienna. And that means an awful lot to me. That, you know, the slow down, you crazy child. You're still, you're so ambitious for a juvenile. But if you're so smart, then why are you still so afraid? And I was like, ah, okay. So this song was written in the 70s, I think. It must be normal that I'm feeling this way. And so I think I've been slowly getting used to the fact that it's gonna calm down, and I'm gonna get used to this sort of way of. Do you know what I'm saying?
I've got to tell you, I didn't think this conversation was going to take a Billy Joel turn. I mean, I don't know that song. I know Billy Joel's hits.
Vienna,
but I don't
waits
know.
Waits for you. You know that song?
No. When you said Vienna, I just thought of Ultravox. I'm not saying this funny. Sing me a bit of Billy Joel's Vienna.
All right, okay.
It's a very dad thing to do. You go, yeah, sing it. As it goes, sing it for me.
The chorus is very difficult to do because he's obviously a wonderful singer. But Lee, the goes, slow down, you crazy child. You're so ambitious for a juvenile. But if you're so smart, then why are you still so afraid? Can we just play it for you? That's what
I've definitely never heard that before. Have you actually
I
got it?
I can't believe it. Yeah, right. Yeah, no, of course I have the internet.
Not ring, it's
Mark.
Not ringing. Oh, you have the internet. Of course you do. Yes. Sorry. Yes, have you got it on you? Yes, I have the internet. I have everything in the whole of civilization ever.
It's from The Stranger. I think it's one of his biggest albums.
Yeah, I got to also tell you, I've never bought a Billy Joel record in my life.
You're going to sing it so much better than me.
Well, he's Billy Joel, Jack.
Slow down, you crazy child. You're so ambitious for a juvenile. But then if you're so smart, tell me why are you still so afraid?
Yeah, no, I preferred you doing it. It's enough. No, I'm sorry.
But that song means an awful lot to me. And helped me realise the fact that the stuff that I'm feeling in my 20s, and I think it's a very normal thing. So if you're in your 20s and you're feeling like you don't know what you're doing, that's normal. That's exactly what you should be feeling. But also, don't rush. There's a big trend as well going around on this new thing called TikTok, Mark.
TikTok.
Where somebody... Yeah, TikTok. It's, you know, the
TikTok
app.
I mean, I know of it. I've not been on it. I understand.
You'll get addicted.
I understand that it was instrumental in toppling Donald Trump, but I'm not sure how.
That's all you care about. But there's a trend where people are asking, what's something you wish you knew in your 20s now that you're in your 30s? And a lot of the advice is just chill out, do what you want, and don't feel like you need to figure it out and know exactly what you're doing, because you don't. And so that's kind of how I'm feeling now at 29, is that I'm looking forward to 30 rather than dreading it.
I mean, I've got something to tell you, Jack. I mean, I'm nearly 60. Go on. You don't really figure things out much more as you go on. I mean, two things I'll tell you as old man advice. The first is that in my experience, life gets better exponentially. Like, you know, so your 30s are better than your 20s, and your 40s are better than your 30s, and that has been my experience of it. I think anyone who tells you that school days are the best days of your life should be locked up. Because right. I think it's just a completely insane thing to say. And if your school days were the best days of your life, you just think, well, what's the point?
Well, even in cinema, there's like a glorification of youth, isn't there? There's a real like nostalgic look at things, which actually brings us on.
Well done.
Here we go.
Well done. So from this rather lovely subject, but finish my advice is, everything gets better. The more you know, the better it is. And also, the more you realize that you don't know anything, but the more you kind of learn to appreciate stuff. And I would absolutely agree with you about the thing about, you know, in your 20s, here's the one thing I can guarantee you in your 20s, you look fantastic. You know, everyone I have ever met, myself included, looks back at pictures of themselves in their 20s and goes, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, I looked great. By the time you get to 60, believe me, what you look like in 20s. Anyway,
care anymore?
Do I care? No, I'm married.
Right. So all that just goes out the window. You get what you pay for. This is it.
Yeah, I literally, I said I do and put on 2 stone like that. It was like I was 2 stone heavier when I came out of the.
I don't think people talk about that enough. The fact that when you're married, you put on weight.
It was just, you know, I kind of felt like I could relax. You know, I mean, I'd won, right? I had married the woman of my dreams. So okay. And, you know, and she stuck with me, despite the fact that I've got exponentially larger. So there we go. I mean, she still looks like the day I married her. Met her, you know, there we are. It's just a thing, you know, apparently.
I mean, we are heading towards Valentine's Day as well. This is all thematically very, like,
it is. Which I like leads it. Us rather nicely, Jack, to the subject of this week's podcast. What is it?
Well, Eliana and Heather, who work on this show, suggested that we talk about Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet because it's the 25th anniversary.
Apparently.
Did my heart love till now? Forswear at sight, for I never saw true beauty till this night.
Scene. Two households, both alike in dignity.
Throw your mischievous weapon to the ground!
From forth the fatal loins of these two foes, where civil blood makes civil hands unclean, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life.
Who is it that you love?
Gentle Romeo, if thou dost love, pronounce it faithfully.
My heart's dear love is set on the fair daughter of rich Capulet.
Romeo! Thou art a villain!
Sharing someone else's...
Turn it off!
Turn it off!
Romeo, slew Tybalt! Romeo, must not live!
My only love sprung from my only hate.
Romeo is vanished!
What do you think about Baz Luhrmann? Are you a fan of Baz Luhrmann's work?
I am, so I'm going to begin this by telling you my Baz Luhrmann story, which is that many years ago, when Baz Luhrmann made a film called Australia, which then became the subject of a joke, Australia, what all of it, which then ran and ran for years. I was sent by the Culture Show to interview Baz Luhrmann in Australia about Australia. Now, if people ever say to me, have you been to Australia? I say no, because I haven't. I have actually been in Australia for 18 hours. And what I did was I flew.
You were just in buildings, right?
No, I've just flew from here to Australia. I landed in Australia, in Sydney. I went out to the Fox building to see some stuff. I went to Baz Luhrmann's house. I spent 5 hours with Baz Luhrmann. I got in a car. I went back to the airport. There was a thing that happened at a restaurant, which I'll tell you about. And I got on a plane and I flew back. And the two reasons that sits heavy with me is firstly, because those 5 hours with Baz Luhrmann were quite remarkable, because despite the fact that I had traveled for 25, 26 hours to get there, and I was about to travel 25, 26 hours back, for the 5 hours that I was in his company, I felt more awake than you can imagine, because he is like a ball of energy. Mm. And, you know, when you can tell this from his movies, it's just the energy just fires off him, and just being in his company is quite tiring. But
it reminds me of something that I've heard Martin Scorsese say, which is that he said that directing is just trying to show an audience the way that you see the world. And actually, it doesn't surprise me that Baz Luhrmann is full of energy, because
that is clearly how he sees the world. He's not anybody who needs any more sugar in his life. And so there was that. And then the second thing was that I, on the way back, so literally, so 26 hours and then 18, 26 hours back. On the way back, I got off the plane into a cab to interview Charlie Kaufman.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, I mean, we already know how you feel about him.
Well,
so
I do not. Actually,
jet lag.
I thought it went quite well. But then by that point, my head was kind of slightly...
For what film?
For Synecdoche, New York. Yeah, which
okay.
I don't want.
Yes, yeah, so, I only saw that when I was a teenager, and I was like, oh yeah, she's buying a house that's on fire, and she's doing it because she's not looking after herself, and it's about how she's doing something even though she knows it's dangerous. I get it. That's how I felt about it when I saw it.
Yeah, I kind of feel that. I just get the way I feel about Synecdoche, New York now is, yeah. Anyway, yeah, that's great. Thanks, Charlie. Anyway, so I'm a fan.
I like
of
Charlie Kaufman.
I also
I'm Thinking of Ending Things more than you do.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, I absolutely love Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and I love being John Malkovich, and he has been involved in some films which I hold dear, and therefore the fact that he can be an arse doesn't matter, because, you know, there are plenty of people who can make great work who can
it's
also
like being
be...
in the playground and I don't know the other kid.
No, exactly. Okay, so... Anyway, so yes, I like Baz Luhrmann very much, and that, which was consequently why I agreed to go to the other side of the world to interview him for Australia. Mm. What all of it? And the thing that I like about him, and this was exactly the thing that some people didn't like about him. I had been in a screening of Moulin Rouge, and Mark Lawson was in the screening room, and if I remember correctly, Mark didn't like the film because he just thought it was too much going on. And I remember watching it thinking, this is great. There's so much going on. And I think there is a kind of frenetic energy to his filmmaking that can sometimes strike a bum note for some audiences. But if mm-hmm. you're in the mood for Luhrmann, it's absolutely right. And I remember seeing Romeo and Juliet when it first came out and thinking, if you'd explained that movie to me, I would have said it would never work, as of course he did. I mean, when he went to the studios and said, I'm going to do it, and they said, okay, who are you going to get to rewrite it? And he went, no, we're going to use the Shakespearean dialogue. And they went, what? And he went, yeah, we're going to use the Shakespearean dialogue, but, you know, modern setting. We go, they went, what? And he went, yeah, it. I think it's fine. You know, hundreds of years people have put up with it. I think it's absolutely fine. And I, you know, the whole story about in order to get it made, they basically, Leonardo DiCaprio basically went and videoed the whole thing in advance to show them that it would work.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Yeah, because it was a project that he absolutely believed in. So it's, you know, he had, you know, great credit to him for doing, they effectively made a version of the film in advance to show the studio to go, look, this will work. So tell me about your experience of seeing it for the first time.
Well, I don't really remember. It feels like one of those things that's always existed. So I don't really have much memory of it. I rewatched it before this podcast, and I also watched The Great Gatsby for the first time. Oh. And my opinion on both of them is kind of similar. And I'm not a big fan of Baz Luhrmann's work, I'll be honest. I feel like it's interesting because I can look at somebody like Zack Snyder or Michael Bay, and I can go, I think that is bad filmmaking. I think that like, oh, Michael Bay is emphasizing everything, so therefore he's emphasizing nothing. And I think that's bad storytelling and bad filmmaking. And with Baz Luhrmann, it's like a Marmite situation. It just doesn't work for me. I can see what he's going for. And actually, you just pointed out like the frenetic editing and things like that, which is exciting. And I would call it frantic editing that sort of put me off. And I was like, just chill out, calm down. Let me just experience things. Sometimes the editing in both of the films put me in mind of Bohemian Rhapsody. Like it felt like it was like,
that's
like
harsh. That's
choose
harsh.
A perspective. No, honestly, watch a scene and just click your fingers every time that the shot changes.
No, I know, yeah.
But like, sometimes it was like, choose a perspective to tell the scene from. It felt like you needed to see everybody's reaction to everything in a close-up. Something that I did enjoy is obviously this predates something like Snatch, but it, like the beginning of Romeo and Juliet, I forgot that he basically just like the gangster title cards for like who everybody is. And I really like the interpretation at the beginning of essentially taking the prologue of Romeo and Juliet, which obviously tells you the ending, and you know, says like, oh, they're going to die. The soliloquy, I think it's called, at the beginning of Romeo and Juliet.
It is the tragedy of Romeo and Juliet. It's, you know, that's how it's going to work, right?
Yeah. But I like the interpretation that he does that, you know, on the television screen by a newscaster, but then takes that step further and shows you a trailer for the film you're about to watch.
Yeah.
I really, really liked that. I forgot that he did that. And that was something that I was like, that's cool. I in terms of like adapting it for a film, that's something that I think is like a nice adaptation. But I don't know. I there's not much in Romeo and Juliet for me. And Eliana, before we started this, showed us that she has these little figurines, these little pop, what are they called, like pop figurines of Romeo and Juliet. And as soon as she showed them to me, I was like, oh no, she's going to be listening and I'm just going to be like, I don't really like it. it's I think it's fine mostly, but I don't know, like there's just nothing in it that like stands out as like, oh yeah,
nothing that stands out.
I don't, not really. I mean,
okay,
what
okay, is, well, okay, well, let's,
does,
well,
let's, what does
let's
it start, tickle for you?
Well, a number of things. Firstly, because, you know, Romeo and Juliet has been filmed umpteen different times, you know, whether it's the Zeffirelli or whether it's the, you know, recently the Julian Fellowes version, in which Julian Fellowes thought that he could do a better version of the Shakespeare than Shakespeare could, or, you know, West Side Story and, you know, yeah. Abel Ferrara's China Girl. I interviewed Abel Ferrara once. Abel Ferrara is the guy who made Driller Killer and then went on to make, you know, a bunch of, you know, much more acceptable films, although he made Pasolini recently and he's always been a but he made China Girl, which is a kind of, you know, it's a version of Romeo and Juliet, and the studio said, do they have to die at the end? And Abel Ferrara said, did you not graduate? what happened? It's Romeo and Juliet. And so I think the fact that it's something that I have seen on film many, many times, the Luhrmann version was not something that I would have expected. As I said, I wouldn't have expected it to work. I mean, there's a lot of things you can break it down and go, okay, well, I love the fact that his music choices are as good as they are. I love the way in which he uses Radiohead. I love the fact that the film ends, you know, end song for a film by Radiohead. you know, the Stina Nordenson. I love that kind of that jukebox sensibility about it. I love the fact that it's doing something that is genuinely ancient and modern together, which is bold, and you wouldn't think it would work, you know, the rapiers and the pistols and all that stuff.
The detail I like, is that all the guns have like sword names and the logos I think are swords as well. It's a nice little detail. I like that.
And as you say, that thing about, you know, the way in which the, you know, the news reading. So I can imagine a kind of, you know, an avant-garde theatre company doing that.
Yeah.
But what's really fascinating is somebody doing it for a mainstream pop audience. And I guarantee you that a huge number of people saw that film who would not have seen, who would not have had the same relationship with, I mean, Romeo and Juliet.
I'm sure it was a lot of people's first experience of that story.
Yeah. And, but what a, you know, what a great way of saying, look, this is still contemporary and current and lively. I mean, you know, we all think of things like, you know, great Shakespearean adaptations on screen. I mean, some of the Branners, I think, you know, they're full. I mean, I remember seeing Branner's Hamlet and thinking, this is great. You could play this to a, you know, to school kids and they get it as much as anybody else. It's 4 hours long, but it doesn't feel like it. In fact, when I was at Radio One, which was then the hip pop station, that was the, you know, movie of the month. And it was a big success because of the way it looked and because of the people who were in it. But I just think that there is, you know, all Much Ado. I think there is an energy to that film that is true to the original text, but is also playing to an audience who might actually be the same age as the characters are meant to be. Because, you know, generally people forget how young Romeo and Juliet are, and people read it at school and it's, you know, but it's a school text. I thought it was by the time I saw it, I was in my, you know, 30s or 40s, whatever it was. So I can't say, you know, firsthand as a teenager, it worked for me, but I've seen plenty of evidence that it does, that it works.
100%. And this is it, is I objectively can look at it and see that clearly, like the amount of people that I know personally who absolutely love that version of Romeo and Juliet and, you know, all the success it has. And I can see it's a successful interpretation and a really original way of interpreting it. It just didn't do anything for me. Like, especially now because it's dated in its own way, and it was never a big part of my childhood in the way that it was for other people in my generation. So I watch it now and I just go, yeah, I know what this is. When I was about to watch it again, I remember it being very orange. I remember there being
ochre.
And I remember the
ochre glow.
And I remember the fish tank.
Yeah,
and
you remember that because that's the poster, isn't it? The poster is him.
Well, it's the music video
tank
as well. That somebody,
yeah, of course, yeah.
And also it all just makes me think of the play in Hot Fuzz. That they the interpretation that they do in Hot Fuzz is the interpretation of Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, Hot Fuzz is such a great film. Okay, so look, so you watched that and you watched Gatsby. Have you seen the Jack Clayton Gatsby, or was that the first Gatsby on film you'd seen?
I might have seen that one again back in school because we read The Great Gatsby in school, and I liked The Great Gatsby. And it actually, I remember at the time remembering it must have been around 2008 when I was reading it, because I said it was reminding me of Burn After Reading, which is something we've talked about on this before, which is just a film where everybody's sleeping with each other and all these different affairs are happening and then it all blows up. And my teacher was like, oh, interesting. And I was just like, nice, this is I'm getting away with just liking films and just relating it to the text that we're talking about. But I hadn't seen it for a long time.
I've been rewatching The Wire for the second time, and that scene in The Wire when they have the conversation about what Gatsby means.
I haven't seen The Wire, Mark.
Well, listen, I mean, I hadn't before.
I'm just starting The Sopranos. That's what I'm starting now. That's my next journey.
The Wire, I think, is arguably one of the greatest works of art of the last century. I mean, I just think it's just, my mind has been blown. So I watched the whole thing, and now I'm watching the whole thing again.
And you only watched it for the first time during lockdown?
Yeah, 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 because my son...
You've discovered television in lockdown.
You know, yes, it was. I mean, that is absolutely what happened. I discovered television in lockdown, and my son is just a huge obsessive with it. He's watched the whole thing 3 or 4 times, and so... We started watching it and I just was completely gripped. And now we're going through it again because watching it the second time is even better. But it's interesting because there is a whole, I won't spoil it in that case, because at some point you will see it and you will love it. But there is a whole kind of Gatsby section in the prison, in which it's part of the prison reading. I mean, Gatsby is my favorite novel of all time, which is a very, very cliched choice, you know, I mean, it really is. I know it's
so many.
No, exactly. I mean, it just happens to be it's the book I've read more than, I mean, I've read it more than The Exorcist. I mean, it's shorter than The Exorcist, but you know, it's I love that book, and so any adaptation of it it is always for me, you know, how does it match up to the book? And I saw the Clayton when I was at school, and that's, you know, the Rubettes were my favorite band, and you know, Robert Redford with the cap and the thing. He never wears the cap in the film. He wears it in the poster, but he never wears it in the film. Not one frame in the film does he ever put that sodding cap on. So the whole thing's a myth. You never actually see Robert Redford in the film with the cap on. It's just like a lie that I've been sold. And so I went into the Luhrmann incredibly skeptical, because like, why do we need Baz Luhrmann 3D? What are they going to do? The bit when he shoots the Lilo's going to fly out of the swimming pool and come hurtling towards the screen. What? How is this going to work? But then you watch it and you go, oh, okay, actually, that's really good. It's a really interesting adaptation. And Leonardo DiCaprio, who is so great in Romeo and Juliet and has so much...
He's great in everything.
Well, I don't agree with that, but I think that my respect for him, the fact that Romeo and Juliet basically happened because he kind of, because he was willing to go out there and really work it and petition for it. And that, you know, then when it came to taking on Gatsby, which for my money is one of the most, you know, it's one of the great cinema roles. And I think he does it really well.
New York, 1922. The tempo of the city had changed sharply. The buildings were higher. The parties were bigger. The morals were looser and the liquor was cheaper. The restlessness approached hysteria.
Shall we?
Who is this Gatsby?
Do you know him?
War hero.
Mr. Gatsby doesn't exist.
Gatsby? What Gatsby?
I beg your pardon. Mr. Gatsby would like to speak to you alone.
Well, first of all, when I was watching it, my housemate, who's not a massive cinephile like us, he's sort of more casual. He was sat there and he went, "What do you think about this contrast between the old and the new?" Like, he was confused by it. And I just turned to him and went, "It's Baz Luhrmann."
That's what he does.
End of explanation for you. But when I was watching it, I found the first hour very hard to watch. In a very, like, I thought it was very, again, frantic. And the transitions between the real, like, in-camera shots and the CGI was sometimes, it was jolting and jarring. And just on the superficial sort of level, sometimes I was just sort of a little bit like, calm down. Same sort of thing in Romeo and Juliet when I just didn't feel like I could get a grasp on what was going on because everything was just sort of happening so much, so quickly. And then when it starts to settle and you start to, like, get into the story more about the, you know, the relationships between the characters, I settled more. But the thing I was struggling with then was, I don't know who Baz Luhrmann wants me to root for. I don't know if he wants me to be on Gatsby's side and they're having this steamy little affair and it's secretive, but I like it. Or if he wants me to think it's wrong, or and actually, I came away feeling very little about it because I didn't really know what it wanted me to invest in.
Well, I would say that the key thing there is that the whole point about Gatsby is, and you say it's funny that you say like a steamy affair. The whole point of Gatsby is Daisy isn't real. You know that he's not in love with Daisy. He's in love with his idea of Daisy.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the things that the 70s version gets right is that Mia Farrow is quite annoying. Mia Farrow's Daisy is quite annoying. And when you see Daisy and you see everything that Gatsby is putting on her, you go, but how? She's actually just quite annoying. And of course, in the 70s version, she's married to Bruce Dern, who is just brilliant, absolutely, you know, brilliant. And I think that it is true that in the Luhrmann version, the character of Daisy has more depth, because I think in the Clayton version, the character of Daisy is completely one-dimensional. But the story is still fundamentally that Gatsby is not in love with Daisy. Gatsby is in love with himself. He's in love with this idea of the past, and that whole thing about, you know, you can't bring back the past. Of course you can. Of course you can. I mean, I think that's, you know, I mean, this, I'm not, I don't think I'm saying anything that's particularly insightful. I mean, everybody, it's kind of evident, but I quite like the fact that you came out of it not knowing who Luhrmann wanted you to invest in, because I think that's actually in the story. I mean, of course, the novel is very much a love story between the narrator and Gatsby, because Nick is kind of in love with Gatsby. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and all the way through all that narration, it's kind of like a love letter to this figure that Nick fell in love with and couldn't understand why Gatsby was then in love with. And certainly at no point in the novel is there any sense that his relationship with Daisy is steamy. I mean, it's just totally abstract. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, she is.
But in the Baz Luhrmann version, they like sneak off at a party and end up making out behind a tree.
The Luhrmann version kind of.
Tobey Maguire is there.
Yeah, it kind of picks it up a little bit. It sexes it up, but it's still, I think it makes sense that you still don't know how he wants you to feel about it or how he wants you to care about it. Because I think,
and I like that sort of stuff in stories and in film a lot, where it's frustrating or you feel one way and then another, and it's confusing in that way. But here it was like, it was just so confusing that I almost couldn't invest at all. So I was like, I was trying to pick up the pieces of what it is that he wanted me to follow, and I couldn't grasp onto anything. It all just felt a little bit indecisive. I didn't know whose perspective were being...
Jack, your room is falling down. Your birthday, your
my birthday celebration,
are falling off the wall.
My flimsy
they
birthday
literally
celebration,
literally falling off the wall. That's
for
so
the listeners.
Sad.
My banner just fell down behind
that's
me.
So sad.
I'm also wearing a party hat.
You are.
I don't know if I pointed this out to the listeners at all. There's balloons around me. This is lockdown self care.
Yeah, if you're listening to this and you want to see this, you can go to our Patreon page where you can see a video of Jack in the saddest birthday party gear you've ever seen.
How dare you?
It's in the middle of lockdown. I mean, everyone. The thing is, lockdown's been going on for a year, so everyone's had a birthday in the middle of it. So, you know, it's. But okay, so
I put balloons everywhere. So,
On a wider Lerman question, have you seen? Did you see Australia? I imagine not.
No, I didn't, because that was 2006, I think. So it was like just before I was starting to properly get into movies, because you got to remember, in 2006 I was 14.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And why would a 14-year-old watch Australia? In fact, no, I mean, it's true, because one of the things about Australia was that it was not a film that was well received.
Right.
And it was a film, they finished it and then it got really terrible previews, and then they went back and they reshot it so that the Drover, you know, in one version of the film, he doesn't. And in the other version of the film, he does. And you know, when you see the film, it does look like...
Didn't he get nominated for Oscars? I remember it being at the Oscars for some reason. That's like a vague...
If it got nominated for Oscars, it will have been nominated only for things like, you know, Best Achievement in Horse Wrangling. I'm just gonna look it up here.
Because, I'm gonna do the same,
because I don't. It got very poorly reviewed. It didn't do great box office. It was not considered to be one of Lerman's best. But I kind of liked it, not least because I've just got a huge soft spot for Hugh Jackman. Or Hugh
got
Jackson.
A Teen Choice Award.
It got a what?
Nomination. It got a Teen Choice Award nomination.
Yeah, but crucially, it didn't get a Teen Choice Award win. It just got a Teen Choice Award nomination. I mean, that's it. So its slate was that it got a Teen Choice Award nomination. And I think in a nutshell, Jack, there we are. How many Oscars did it get nominated for, Jack?
I don't think any.
None. That would be.
I don't think any.
Yeah, I don't think any. It was not a film that was.
No, it got best costume design.
It got nominated
for best costume design.
So that was it.
It won best cinematography and best supporting actor at the Film Critics Circle of Australia.
Yeah, okay, that's a small field. I mean, the cinematography is really great. You know, it is really good, but it's It's like when you have festival awards and the film won best of the festival. You go, great. What else was on there? Oh, I see. Suddenly that's a huge festival hit. Yeah. Yeah, generally not. But anyway, but I liked it. I enjoyed it. But then part of the reason that I enjoyed it was because I've got a fondness for Baz Luhrmann. And, I like the energy of his films. I mean, I have disagreements with my partner about this, who doesn't feel the same way about Moulin Rouge as I do. I mean, I loved Strictly. I thought Strictly was, you know, and of course, Strictly has now become part of the national consciousness. We wouldn't have Strictly, whatever it is.
Literally,
now.
As you were like, Strictly? I was like, what do you mean? Yeah, well, and you know, I forgot for a second that it wasn't just a television
that
joke.
That it comes from Baz Luhrmann. You know, it comes from Strictly Ballroom, which is a really funny, arch film at that time that, you know, that was what Australian kind of, you know, darkly satirical, humorous movies looked like. And I'm actually really looking forward to the fact that he's now going to make this, you know, Elvis and the Colonel film. And, you know, I think that sounds fascinating. Tom Hanks is going to play the Colonel, and they're looking for an unknown to play Elvis. I don't know whether they've cast that yet. The last I heard they were still looking. And, you know, that's fascinating, because, I mean, the last time I interviewed Tom Hanks and I asked him about the Colonel thing, and he made the mistake of saying, yeah, well, a book by Peter Guralnik. I don't know whether I said, yeah. And then we started, and I said, I'll tell you a whole bunch of stuff about Cornelius Van Hoyk. What do you want to know? So I think Tom is now considering me to be his actual, you know, inside track.
Well, you heard it here first. But actually, to bring it round to what we were talking about at the beginning, which is advice for the youth and things like that, I think the best thing that Baz Luhrmann has made is sunscreen.
Oh, which is just lovely, isn't it? Absolutely lovely. And in fact, funnily enough, when we were talking earlier on about, you know, believe me, you look fabulous and all that stuff, that is a kind of gag which comes back to that sunscreen thing, which for anyone who doesn't know it, which I'm amazed if
definitely
they don't,
listen to it. If you haven't heard it before or you haven't heard it for a while, put it on now and listen to it. It's
a graduation speech read over a piece of kind of, you know, ambient dance music. And it's the advice for, you know, people going forward. And it's wear sunscreen. And then there's a whole bunch of other stuff. But it comes back
to...
Be
nice to your hair.
Be nice
to your...
I remember
that one.
That's right.
Ladies and gentlemen of the class of 99, wear sunscreen. If I could offer you only one tip for the future, sunscreen would be it. The long-term benefits of sunscreen have been proved by scientists, whereas the rest of my advice has no basis more reliable than my own meandering experience.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so generally, the 25th anniversary of Romeo and Juliet, and it's, you know, and it's Valentine's, all the rest of it, you're not a fan.
I'm not really a fan, really. And I get why people are, and I would never begrudge. I would never hear someone was a fan of Baz Luhrmann and go, oh, why? It's just not for me. Like I say, I don't think you can be objectively, you can't objectively look at his films and go, no, this doesn't work. I think I'm just going, this the taste of it doesn't sit well for me. And also, just my final thought on Romeo and Juliet, and this probably just goes for it as a whole. Now that I'm older and I'm not sort of in this sort of lustful teenage sort of mindset where I'm just excited to watch two people kiss and that means that they're in love. I was watching it and genuinely watching it and being like, these stupid fucking teenagers. Like, that was literally like my entire mindset had shifted from this, like watching 500 Days of Summer for the first time and being like, this is just like, oh, just imagine like the idea of being involved in this exciting new thing. And now I just look at it and go, this just looks exhausting. And you're being idiots.
Yeah, if somebody just taken him aside and said, look, grow up. He's not the right for you. She's not right for him. Just
you've honestly, known each other for 3 days.
Seriously, yeah. Just grow up.
You had a few nice kisses. It doesn't mean you're in love.
I'll leave you with this. The thing that Baz Luhrmann said to me that is a quote that I have repeated many times because it's, if somebody says something to me that's memorable, I just roll it out at every possible opportunity. When I was in Australia interviewing Baz Luhrmann about Australia, I'll tell you the bag story in a minute as well.
Yes, the whole thing.
Baz Luhrmann said, I said, look, what's this film about? Because I mean, it's basically, you know, it's like it's The Wizard of Oz and it's Gone with the Wind and it's, you know, it's all these things and it's, you know, it's a melange of all these things. What is it about for you? And Baz Luhrmann said, well, you know, here's the interesting thing about Australia. We have more nothing than anywhere else on Earth. And that's kind of what the film is about. And I just love that phrase, that Australia has more nothing than anywhere else on Earth. And it is true that it is still one of the very few places that you can drive for 2 hours and get dangerously lost, like in the middle of nothing for days and days and days of nothing.
Suppose that you could film that. I don't know why.
He managed to do it and he managed to make it exciting. And I'll finish this by telling you the story. So I went out with David Shulman, who was the director.
Is this the restaurant story?
This is the restaurant story. Have I told you this before?
I'm not sure.
Okay, well, you know, some podcast listeners won't have heard this. So there's a restaurant So David Shulman and I, we went out, we did the thing. I think David had been out there for a while, and we were coming back. And so we'd done the film, 5 hours of filming with Baz Luhrmann, three different places that we interviewed him. And we had the bags of videotapes back then, as they were. You know, you have to carry the bags with you because that's it. You know, those tapes are the documentary. And if you lose them, then everything you've spent on getting everyone out there is waste. So you have to take them with you. And you have to take them as hand luggage, right? You have to take them with you. And so we went back to the airport, and we had like about 2 hours to spare before we were going to be in planes for the next 26 hours. And there is a restaurant in the middle of Sydney that's up the top of a tower, and it's got like a panoramic view. Okay. So we went, look, let's go. And I think David might have booked it. He said, you know, it's a quick thing, but look, we go up, you know, you can actually see all of Sydney because you've seen nothing other than a plane, a taxi, a house, a taxi, a plane. So, and we're both holding the rushes. The rushes are the tapes of the thing. Nowadays, you just upload them electronically, but back then you had to physically carry them with you.
It's like the end sequence of Argo.
Yeah, exactly like the end sequence of Argo. And we go, and we get into this, we get the thing, and we go in this lift, and the lift goes up the tower, right? And you get to the top of the tower, and the door opens, and it's like the post office tower. You know, it's like a round thing with a complete panorama. And the guy says, oh, you've got a table, blah, 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 blah. Lovely, thank you very much. And he sits us down at the table, and we've both got our bags of rushes, and we put the bag of the rushes down on the, you know, on the floor beside us, and we congratulate ourselves on having done such a brilliant job, and we order a bottle of wine and some food. And we look down, and the bag has gone. It's gone. Like, it's been nicked. It's gone. I mean, we put it down on the floor, and it's
and
gone.
It's not there no more.
It's not there. And we have a complete shit fit, okay? Like, oh, my, you know.
And it's even worse, the fact that you've travelled across the world.
Yeah. So here's what happened. It's okay. It's a revolving restaurant.
Brilliant.
And we didn't know. And the brilliant. The seam was by the side of the table. And we both put our bags down. And the restaurant moved about 20 foot. Our bag was for somebody else.
So you didn't know. So you weren't spinning.
We were spinning. You were spinning,
but you didn't know you were spinning.
But no, we had no idea. I mean, by this point, we were quite tired.
And tipsy, I imagine.
Yes, and the restaurant was moving round, so the bags went the other way.
And I can see this. I can see Peter Sellers performing this gag. It's the exercise poles from one of the Pink Panther movies. It's like, oh yeah, I remember this. And then he jumps over the side and goes down the stairs. It's the exact same sort of physical humour. Putting something on a car and then it drives away. You're in a slapstick movie on your own.
I am. In Australia. What? All of it.
Okay. I'd like to see that version of Baz Luhrmann's Australia. I'd like to see Baz Luhrmann direct that.
Yeah, well, now you see. Now you can tell why I will always have a fondness for Baz Luhrmann. Now, last time we were together, we were talking about feel-good movies, and we asked people to feel-good heartfelt movies, to give us some suggestions for things that work for them. We had loads and loads.
So many people tweeted us
of suggestions.
Their version. And so many people as well have said that you should definitely revisit Little Miss Sunshine.
But yes,
I think a
absolutely.
Lot of people think that's a heartwarming film.
How did it happen?
How did what happen?
Your accident.
Uncle Frank didn't really have an accident. He tried to kill himself.
Why?
I wanted to kill myself because I was very unhappy.
He's a sick man. He's a sick in his head now.
Richard.
I don't think it's an appropriate conversation for a 7-year-old.
Well, she's going to find out anyway.
Oh, okay.
Why were you unhappy?
I fell in love with someone who didn't love me back.
Who?
One of my grad students. I was very much in love with him.
Him? You fell in love with the boy?
Very much so.
That's silly.
There's another word for it.
Dad. There is a message in the machine. Something about Little Mrs. Sunshine.
Little Miss Sunshine?
Yeah.
What?
Remember when Olive was runner-up in the regional Little Miss Sunshine? That's the girl who won had to forfeit her crown. I don't know why, something about diet pills, but anyway, now she has a place in the state contest in Redondo.
Okay, so the last time we were together, we were discussing feel-good movies, you know, movies that we think were heartfelt, and we said, look, give us your suggestions, and we've had loads of responses to this. So look, here are just some of the responses that we've had to this. I'll read a few and then you can read a few. Okay, so this is on Twitter. This is from Stephen. Midnight Run. I can't watch it enough. De Niro and Grodin, amazing. Agent Foster Grant, his daughter, offering him all her money. I could go on, but there's a character limit. Serrano's got the tapes. I mean, I love Midnight Run. That's a
I haven't seen Midnight Run. Oh. That's been on my list for a while.
Oh, it's great. It's genuine. It's really funny. That's a very good
tonally. Movie. What's it like?
It's like a kind of, it's like a dark screwball comedy with two characters, you know, chalk and cheese characters. Bound together, and during the course of the journey, they reluctantly...
Is it Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, but darker?
I'd never thought of it like that, but actually, now you say it, yes.
Okay, well, I'm into that.
It's just genius. It is properly fun. It is properly laughing.
And is it De Niro before he, you know,
it was the first time I'd ever seen De Niro being funny. I mean, like, properly right. funny. Yes, it's just, it's absolute, it's a gem. Okay, this is from Kitty Robertson. My feel-good movie, always, always and forever, is I Know Where I'm Going. Wildly romantic and funny and magical, and without it, we wouldn't have Local Hero, which is absolutely true. Also an example of a good movie with an exclamation mark in the title. This is because I asked rather foolishly on the radio. I said, are there any good movies with an exclamation mark? And so, you know, I think Australia's got an exclamation mark. you know, it's...
I'll check for you now.
I have this...
It doesn't.
Why do I think it does? It kind of feels like it ought to, because it has Moulin Rouge got an exclamation mark.
Australia!
You know, Great Gatsby! So you kind of feel like every Baz Luhrmann movie has probably got an exclamation mark after it. Australia ought to have a
Moulin
question.
Rouge has got an exclamation mark.
There we go. That's
what
I'm thinking. Okay, so Moulin Rouge has got an exclamation mark. Okay, that's a great choice. This is from Matt. I always enjoy Lucas Moodysson's Together, Till Samans. Achieves the not unimpressive feat, spoilers, of making you hope a family where physical abuse has taken place can get back together again. Great use of ABBA too. Love the show. Thanks. But, I mean, I remember seeing Together when it was a first preview screen and absolutely loving it. And then wondering why Lucas Moodysson never made another film like that, because his career took a bit of a different turn. And then this is from Linz and Dark Within. Empire Records. Ooh. Empire Records is my go-to feel-good film. It definitely has a cult following, but I'd be interested to know what Mark thinks of it, though I fear you hate it. I'll be honest with you, I don't even remember. I mean, I remember it, and I know that I've seen it, but I remember absolutely nothing about it. Have you seen Empire Records recently?
I've never even heard of it.
It does have a kind of culty thing. Yeah, I saw it when it first came out, and it has not troubled my mind since then. So I never
would probably like it. I mean, I'm just looking at the poster and the Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
Empire Records is a 1995 American coming of age comedy drama film.
Yeah, yeah.
Honestly, but I have me at comedy drama coming of age. Like, that is absolutely my jam. I'd probably be into this.
I haven't seen it since then. I really haven't seen it since then.
Oh, my Lord. The film was a flop. It made only $150,000 in its opening weekend.
Yeah.
That is bad.
Yeah. I mean, it's
not to say it's not good, but it has an approval rating of 29% on Rotten Tomatoes. That is not a very well-liked film critically, but I can imagine... Because I like the film Take Me Home Tonight. That's one of my, like, go-to feel-good films, which is a film that was made in 2007, but not released until 2011, starring Topher Grace and Anna Faris, and Chris Pratt's in it, and... not Josh Gad, what's his name, the one who's in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. He's a fantastic actor. I'm doing him a disservice by not remembering his name, but that film was shelved.
There are a lot of people in Fantastic Beasts.
Dan Fogel, I think, is his name.
Okay.
But that film is critically panned, but I just find it so charming. That's another one of those ones that I always go back to, even though I know everybody usually hates it.
Okay, now, do you have some suggestions from listeners for feel-good films?
I have so many. First of all, thank you everybody who agrees with me on Hook. And we even had the screenwriter of Hook tweet us saying,
I saw.
Thank you for your kind words. And it's nice to know that the legacy lives on. Amazing. It's wonderful to know that.
Isn't that amazing?
It is. I
had a message from my friend Lucy who said, the screenwriter of that film is a friend of mine and was really quite chuffed.
I'm so pleased. Honestly, it's a childhood favourite of mine, and it's a little bit strange and surreal to know that the screenwriter has heard my kind thoughts on it. Kim has also said, Hook is my childhood. So thank you very much, everybody. But somebody has said their feel-good film is Fighting With My Family, which I really enjoyed when it came out.
Yeah, I love that.
That was a really... Somebody, weirdly, this is a controversial one. Matthias, I think his name is, has said Green Book felt very wholesome. And I agree. When I saw Green Book for the first time, it was early December. It was just a random preview screening. There was no buzz about it. There was no chat about it. Me and my friend Jacob went to go see it. It finished and we looked at each other and went, that was quite nice. Wasn't that quite a nice film? And then it won Best Picture at the Oscars, and now I just hate it by principle.
I'd just like to refer you to Simon Mayo's comment, Driving Miss Green Book. This time,
yeah, absolutely.
This time the racist is in the front seat.
My top five feel-good picks, this is from William Burnett. Babe, excellent. Mm-hmm. I'd like to remind everybody that that Babe, Pig in the City was directed by George
Miller did the first
George
one.
Miller
well, George
yeah
Miller
no
the
George f- Miller did he did the
he
second
did sequel,
one
sequel as well did he
he didn't direct the first one. He directed the second one, Babe, Pig in the City.
Who directed
as well as
the first one?
So the first one was directed by Chris Noonan.
I beg your pardon. So George Miller, who directed George Miller,
he wrote the first one though.
Yeah, who did Mad Max? But you know that there is another George Miller.
Is there?
Yes, there is.
This
always used to get confusing. There is another filmmaker called George Miller who is not that George Miller, and people often go, what, the guy who made Happy Feet is the same guy that made Mad Max? And you go, yeah, that is the same George Miller.
But there is also
another George Miller, yes.
But the one that you think might be the different George Miller, that is the same one.
It is the same George Miller, yeah.
So William said Babe, Scott Pilgrim, which I think is a great choice.
Wall-E,
which we spoke about before. I'm not a massive fan of Wall-E, but I do see why people do like it.
Yeah.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And then a strange one, Let the Right One In.
Okay, well, I love that film. And I think that's, you know, how great that they chose that role.
And we spoke about it last time that it's difficult to pick feel-good, heartwarming films because actually the context in which you see the film can change it. Because for me, as well, another one that I didn't think would be appropriate to bring up on the list, but The Silence of the Lambs is, for me, quite a comforting film because I watched it for the first time with my mom, who was like, you're going to love this. And I just associate it with that experience now. So it's quite a comforting film for me to watch, even though it's not a comforting film at all.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just your memory of your experience of seeing it.
Exactly, yeah. Even though it's about a man who eats people.
Okay, so I just like
to wear skin.
I just like to confirm that so I'm not going crazy. So yes. So the other George Miller is the guy who directed The Man from Snowy River. And he's also a film, and he directed a film called The Aviator in 1985, but not that one.
Right, and, okay. other George Miller directed The other Aviator.
Yeah, yeah, and The Man from Snowy River, which is a kind of very, very well-respected film. And he was born in Scotland. So there are two... And apparently, around the time of Mad Max, there was a lot of, oh, that's the guy that made Mad... No, it's not. It's the guy who made The Man from Snowy River.
Also, this other George Miller... He directed, I find this so funny, The Neverending Story 2, the Next Chapter.
and you know, and here's the thing about The Neverending Story. It never ends.
Right. But there is a sequel.
Okay. I feel we've gone off piste here, Jack, but I just want to get, I'm kind of at the age when if I remember that there are two George Millers, then I have to go, hang on, did I just make that up? So now we had a couple of Patreon mentions. Have you got them, Jack? We had to cover some from our Patreon listeners. We got one here.
I've only got tweets.
Okay, this is from Ben on Patreon, and this says, this might be a little embarrassing to admit, but the first thing I thought of was Shrek 2. I've watched it more times than I can count, and it never fails to make me smile.
I don't think that's embarrassing to admit at all. Shrek 2 and actually Shrek 1, the first two Shreks, are both hilarious and actually started a trend, I think, of really using pop culture references in animated movies in a way that felt kind of fresh and original at the time. I know that Disney had flirted with it with Aladdin by getting Robin Williams to impersonate Jack Nicholson, and, well, not getting him to, but letting Robin Williams just do whatever he wants, like flirting with that idea of referencing other pop culture within it. But Shrek and Shrek 2 seem to really like go hard on that in a way that is very, very funny. Now, and it still remains to be kind of feel original by them doing it, even though now, you know, the Lego movie, which I think is great, but also things like Wreck-It Ralph and things like that, you know, the Emoji movie are all really driving that into a place that's getting a little bit old now.
Now, that was from Bex Davison. This is from Ben. Sorry for confusing the two. Hook was the first film that came to mind when I saw the heartwarming theme of this week's podcast. I very much agree with Jack's sentiment. I also saw it in the cinema when it came out in 1991. I have been 10, I'd have must been 10. 10 at the time. So I have fond memories of it, but also any of the Aardman films, absolutely, particularly the two Shaun the Sheep films, which I love. Do you want to read a couple of these?
Yes. Speaking of Aardman, Joseph O'Hara agrees, saying, Chicken Run, how is that not in the top five? Yeah, you're right. Chicken Run is... there are so many people. I even did a separate list on my YouTube channel to sort of to keep the thing going. And people were angry at me for not mentioning Paddington. And I was like, I mentioned Paddington in the podcast. Like, leave me alone. Like, yeah, there are so many. Like, yeah, Chicken Run. I also think I wanted to mention some that people might not expect. But yeah, Chicken Run is fantastic. Joseph also said Lincoln is my feel-good film.
Wow.
Which is very interesting. Again, like, it's such a strange...
Okay, yeah.
It's such a strange one to talk about because it seems to be so personal what people find, because for me as well, like, comforting films are like The Dark Knight and Blade Runner 2049, and I'm not gonna lie, Tenet. Like it's like sitting in something that makes me feel like I'm in my zone.
Yeah, but okay,
I get
but
to just enjoy this.
But here's what's interesting. So Joseph O'Hara says it's my feel good film because it's about a cause being triumphant over the absolute worst of human atrocities, and I feel that after the last 4 years, it's picked up new meaning. And again, that's kind of like, yeah, watch The Dead Zone now. After the last 4 years, The Dead Zone is a different film to the film that we saw when it came out in the 80s, when some of us were born and some of us weren't. I mean, I get that, you know, it's a film, but then that's like, it's like Shawshank Redemption is a feel-good film, despite the fact that there is a lot of Shawshank before the redemption. And just to bring this to a close, Jack, usually around this time, we'd be talking about awards. Obviously, everything has been pushed back to, you know, March, April. We've had some of the Oscar shortlists, disappointingly already. The Oscar shortlist for composers, guess how many women are in the shortlist of 15?
I'm going to guess one.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm. Yep. One. In a year in which we had just numerous brilliant scores written by women, one.
Yep.
Anyway, we'll see what happens as far as the nominations are concerned. You and I will do a responses to the nominations when they get announced, but obviously that's going to be a way off. Mm-hmm. Are you feeling kind of disenfranchised? I mean, I'm a BAFTA member, so I've been BAFTA voting, but how are you feeling about it all? Does it all feel a little bit like, what's going on?
I feel completely out of my zone. Usually around this time, very much in January and early February, I feel like I'm caught up. I know exactly what should be nominated, what will be nominated. It will be disappointing if it's not nominated. And this year, I haven't got a clue. I haven't got a clue what's going on. I don't know what films are supposed to be up for it, what should be a contender, what won't be. I know that when the Golden Globes came out,
Just don't even. I hate the Golden.
I mean, but I just want to just mention the fact that like they didn't, and this is going back to television, but they didn't nominate a TV show called I May Destroy You, which I assume you haven't seen.
No, of course I've seen. I've seen all.
You've seen it.
It's absolutely brilliant. It's one of the
best things. It is astounding.
Last year we did a piece on it on Kermit and Mayer's Home Entertainment Service. Michaela Cole is an absolute genius, and it is one of the most profound pieces of television, or indeed pieces of film I've ever seen.
Yep. Exactly. It is one of the, last year, I think it was my favorite thing that was made.
Yeah.
It is just incredible. Where it starts and where it ends is two different places. The amount of nuance and modern exploration of being a millennial, a creative millennial as well, but also somebody who shares things on the internet and how that can feel, and the complication of cancel culture and whatever that is, and loads of things like that. It's got such a nuanced approach of things like this in a really brave way that I've never seen before.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible.
And it's incredible.
You're two episodes into it before you even figure out the tone of it. And that's the thing, is it's kind of, it's like this is a stupid thing to say, but it's like life. You think you're in one movie and then you discover that you're in another one. And it's, you know...
Like, and this is not a spoiler at all, but in one of the last episodes, somebody says, I thought you were writing about this. And she said, so did I.
Yeah.
And it feels like Michaela Cole let herself develop it and let it go wherever it needed to go. And even just simple things, how it plays with narrative, that you're watching something chronologically for three episodes and all of a sudden it'll just go, no, we're going to do an entire episode that's set 10 years ago. Like, and it's just things like that that are brave ways of telling a story, different ways of telling a story. And it shouldn't be brave. It should be allowed more often, but this just stands out above everything else. I mean, I didn't see, and they didn't nominate it.
Here's the thing. I didn't see what the Globes did or didn't nominate because I could care less. As I've said a million times, the Globes are a boil on the arse of the entertainment industry. And I feel, to repeat a popular phrase, you don't want to give them the oxygen of publicity or indeed the oxygen of oxygen.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and then it feels like they were going like, but we nominated three women for directing.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel like you're paying attention to the industry that you're supposed to be
reflecting.
No, because
they're not. The Hollywood Foreign Press Association. Who the fuck are they?
Yeah.
You look at the list, you go, nope, never heard of any of those people. Don't give a flying fuck what any of them think about anything. These are the people who nominated Burlesque because the film company flew them all to Las Vegas and introduced them to Cher.
Woohoo.
It's like somebody said, isn't that like buying votes? No, it's not like buying votes. It's buying votes. It's actually, it's not like being corrupt. It's being corrupt. They are a bunch of unaccountable bozos who all they are doing is, you know, organizing a nice party for themselves.
They just want to get drunk with celebs.
And unfortunately, it has a poisonous effect on the rest of the, I mean, all awards are inherently stupid, but none are more stupid, more corrupt, more venal, and more of a cyst than the Golden Globes. And the sooner they all fuck the fuck off, the better.
This podcast where Mark is allowed to really let loose. But in terms of like BAFTAs and Oscars, I haven't got a clue. The very last film I was able to see in the cinema before all of it shut down again was Nomadland, which I thought was outstanding.
Yeah, I loved it.
I thought that Frances McDormand was, I mean, is it even worth saying at the moment? She was incredible, obviously. But like even more so than I was expecting, in a completely different way, a much quieter performance than maybe you're used to from Frances McDormand. She's very expressive, but in this, it's much more cerebral and subtle and quieter. And the directing by Chloe Zhao, I think it's Chloe Zhao.
Chloe Zhao,
wonderful. And she edited it as well, and I love that as well, because as somebody who also does that and not to the same level at all, I know that how much of editing is directing, and that I love that she did that for that movie, and it just had me the entire time. So I would expect to see that on the list. That's the only one that I've personally seen. But also from me, not to sound like a broken record, I do think Tenet should be in there, and I don't think it will, because I think it's a technical marvel, first of all, but also the fact that somebody's looking at film in the way that Christopher Nolan is and going, I'm going to do this with it in a way that nobody else at his level is thinking about. And the way that he's... like, if you can... nobody's really as interested as I am in this, but if you go on YouTube and look at the sort of top-down bird's-eye view, like, maps that people have made of, like, here's where all the characters are at one time.
People have had far too much time during lockdown.
Oh, mate. Yeah. Like, ridiculous. It is ridiculous that I'm this interested in it. But if you look at it, you go, how did someone conceive of this? Where, like, they know that they want all these elements to happen, and then he made it happen, and he made it coherent and brilliant to watch. And obviously, I think the only one that's going to get properly acknowledged is Ludwig Göransson for his wonderful, pulsating score. Yeah. And I hope Hoyt gets a nomination for the cinematography as well, because
I'm interviewing Ludwig Göransson on the Monday for the podcast.
Oh, wow.
I'll say hi for
Can me. I be there?
No.
Oh, Mark. You take it. It's my birthday. It's all I want. I can't believe I can't be there. I'd have so much to ask and to talk about. Mark, I can't believe you're breaking a little boy's dream.
You're not a little boy anymore, Jack. You're nearly 30. All right, so look, time to bring this to a close, because we've been going on for much longer than we should do. Obviously, do get in touch if there's anything that you'd like Jack and I to shoot the breeze about. You can either text, get in touch with me on Twitter, which is at Kermode Movie. You can get Jack on Twitter, which is at Jack Howard, or there is at Kermode on Film, or you can get in touch through the Patreon page, which is probably the easiest thing. And Patreon page will also give you access to lots of videos. Like, for example, you could have watched this video of Jack wearing a silly hat
and be part of our little party.
Part of your little party. And Mike Lee could not have come up with a more brilliant kind of dramatization.
And the fact that the banner fell down
was just lovely. That was absolutely lovely.
The comedic timing of just nature.
Yeah. Anyway, Jack, it's been a pleasure. Thanks ever so much, everybody, for listening. Usual stuff, you know, visit the Patreon page, please do. If you've enjoyed this, remember to subscribe, tell your friends. Jack, what, because you've got a whole thing happening, Jack. Just this thing that you've got going at the moment, where should people be finding it? Your new project.
My new project?
Yeah, your YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
Remember this new thing that you're doing,
yeah.
Jack?
Yeah, oh, wow. I wasn't expecting to talk about it. Yeah, I've got a new podcast called The Screen Test, which is where I host a show where me and three other big film fans will duke it out to try and find some of the best film and television ever made. And everybody brings their own film to fight for, and I basically am the decider who gets to decide who is the winner at the end. So we've done best disaster films, we've done best sci-fi, we just did three episodes the other day where we covered the best TV shows of all time, and the best 80s comedies, things like that.
Where can people find it, Jack?
You go to youtube.com/PrimeVideoUK. It's part of the Amazon Prime stuff, but it's a very like passion project show for me. It's something I'm very, very involved with, and hopefully at some point Mark will be on it.
I will.
I'm not sure when.
Well, as soon as I can actually physically get there, because you need me to come to London and I'm not coming.
Yeah, we do it all socially distanced and in different places, but we do it on location.
Yeah, so which is fine, but I live 2 hours away from London, and I obviously at the moment I'm not traveling to London. I'd love to be on it, mm-hmm. and I will be on it as soon as it is safe and healthy to do so.
But yeah, please check it out. It's a really fun chat, and there's some really good people on it as well.
Oh, great. And so I will I look forward to speaking to you again in the very near future, and I'll say hi to Luddy for you.
I can't believe this. Lud. I can't believe you're not letting me be part of this with you. I'll do it for free.
Yeah, that's not a come on.
God's sake.
All right, thanks for listening. Keep watching this, guys. Stay safe, everybody.